It's a question reality. It's one of the things I always like to point out about this film is that the entire film's about 120 setups, and in over 80 of them, you see the three primary colors, red, blue, and yellow. And I've not been able to figure out, this happens in a lot of the Handy films, but they're constructed so as to show these primary colors in almost every scene. I mean, at one point they put three inspection stickers on a car window, red, blue, and yellow, and it's tremendously artificial, but it's some kind of a didactic device. This film in... Yeah, well, but you know why and where. This is a producer whose consciousness was formed at the Columbian Exposition in 1893, and it's hard to place that. This film actually goes quite well with Master Hands, which in some ways is sort of the intellectual and social inverse of this film. So Master Hands is something that I discovered in 1983. It came out of the garage of a gentleman who'd worked at Jam Handy, whose job was to throw it away, and he didn't. And I rewarded him for not throwing it away, and so it was saved. And when I looked at it on the old Ace Viewer, I quickly realized that this was something special, but I didn't get to see it for a couple years till we did a video transfer. It's still a little mysterious why it was made. I've not gone back through General Motors corporate archives, and there's relatively few references to it in the trade press of the time. It was shot at the beginning of 1936, just before, in the early part of the year where the sit-down strikes happened over in the winter of 36-37. The La Follette committee hearings on violations of free speech and rights of labor revealed that 1 out of 10 workers in the Flint plant, where most of this was shot, were on the company payroll for little extra money as labor spies. So when you see this, imagine that 1 out of every 10 workers is finking on the union to management and try to figure out who they might be. It's an industrial symphony. I think that it says that it's a tribute to the workers. I personally think it's less of a tribute to the people that are doing the work than to the people that design the system of mass production. I'll leave that up to you. I think it says some very interesting things about class, and I love its representational strategies. It was the first sound industrial film and the first industrial of the modern era to be chosen for the National Film Registry in 1999, and it's very exciting to be able to show it tonight, and I'd like to thank Film Technology Company and Blue Wave Audio for their major contribution in preserving it and making it possible. And I'd like to ask Alan Stark to make an introduction.
In 1983, Woody Allen brought us Zelig, a character who takes on the persona of those around him. Lately, in my introductions to projects we've done, I've kind of taken the Zelig approach to the introductions. So, here we go. I realize that this is the Chevrolet Motor Company, and I believe that they were not part of General Motors at that point, if I'm not mistaken, but what the heck. The original film, i.e. the camera negative, is the ideal source for making new film elements in the process of preserving a film. Those of you actively involved in film preservation know that the original film may no longer exist, is lost, or simply unavailable. Our work with Master Hands began with a black and white print, not a camera original negative. It is likely, however, that this print was made from the camera original. The print was designed for projection and was not intended as a source for duplication. Like all prints, the higher contrast found in the Master Hands print can be a detriment to image quality when using it to make a preservation negative. Traditional film restoration labs such as us employ a number of techniques in film exposure and film processing to control contrast. These techniques were employed in producing a new negative of Master Hands. The print you will view tonight was made from this new picture negative produced by the Master Hands at Film Technology Company. Tom.
This was definitely a teamwork effort here, so we had to break out all the gloves. What we try to do when we do our audio restoration tracks is to not change the EQ, not adjust anything, just remove the noise and maybe the anomalies that have grown over the years with usage being transferred from print to print. And this particular track didn't offer us a huge challenge. It actually sounds quite well. But being music all the way through, when you try to go after a broadband noise, you actually end up hitting some of the frequencies of the music. So our first step was to make sure that didn't happen. And when you go against a track like this, we're very careful using not only the visual waveform that we see on the computer monitor, but also our ears and our trained ears we go against. So we end up going just far enough so we start to tickle the upper frequencies, and then we back off and we leave a nice, even, steady noise floor that you'll hear throughout this, but you'll probably just ignore it after about a minute because the music sounds so full. We did no EQ to it. We didn't add any low end. It's nice and full, and it was a lot of fun to work on this project. So we can start this.
I think I'd like to thank Alan and Tom again for a really, really beautiful job. It's quite late, but do we have time for questions, if anybody has any?
I have no objection.
You're going to tell us about the score.
The score. Yeah, so the score, if any of the people who know about music are in the audience, I think they'll be able to, it's mostly rewritten from Wagner, right, isn't it, from... Yeah. In fact, there's a music cue sheet which I could find that talks about how they rename those. I don't think there ever was a Detroit Philharmonic Orchestra. No, it's the Detroit Symphony, but the Detroit Philharmonic I think is made up. At the time that this was made, Jam Handy had 600 people on its staff, including, I'm told, two full orchestras because they were. On staff because they were so busy, but it's rewritten Wagner, and it's really elemental. You know, you see earth, air, fire, and water, and in Reel 1 and 2, and this is very much these derivative themes. Yeah, Don.
Do you think there's any connection to Chaplin's Modern Times?
That's sort of in the air, then, isn't it? I mean, it was produced the same year as Modern Times. So what happens at Jam Handy, it's really interesting. They produce a lot of these films that are incredibly beautifully executed, but very often you can trace the intellectual roots of the ideas behind the films back to another source. So, for example, they do tons of stop-motion animation that's, I think, derivative of Fischinger and a lot of the Europeans. American Look, Reel 3, which you haven't seen but you can look at online, is remarkably derivative it seems very much like a film that Ford made, The Human Bridge, in 1950. The newsreels that Jam Handy made for Chevy are an awful lot like the Ford, educational weeklies and so on and so on. So in this case, I think they're very much attuned. I don't know what the time sequence is because I think this came out around the same time as Modern Times, if not before. Yeah. Superscope was it's typically 2 to 1. Sometimes it's 2.35 to 1. It took hold mostly in Japan, I think, but a bunch of industrials were made in the States. That's a good question for James. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Superscope. The question being, could we find out anything about Superscope?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you deserve a hand anyway.
Right, so, of course, Fox having its patent on CinemaScope and Paramount having a desire to come up with a rival format came up with acquisition format that we all know as VistaVision, for which it was that widescreen release prints with non-anamorphic processes were available. The SuperScope was yet another rival widescreen format that was shot, as you know, with an anamorphic format, but didn't rely on patent restrictions and borrowing the name CinemaScope, so thereby calling it SuperScope, and allowed for a lot of theaters that didn't have the proscenium width to show widescreen and yet not have to compromise composition by not cropping, by cropping, of course, the wider format. I can't tell you more than that, only that I'm sure there was a studio associated with SuperScope, but I'm not sure which one, I'm afraid. Nonetheless, that's my two bits. I apologize for the, of course, head-tail splice. Of course, it's an archive print. We only have one machine, and as such, we couldn't necessarily you know, cut this. So,
Once upon a honeymoon, we saw a clip of Today the Telephone film was actually shot in SuperScope, but I'm not aware of any SuperScope prints around unless UCLA got one. Yeah. Help me. Yes.
And so do you think that Master Hands or other films would have been used by salespeople for their communities, the way they're talking about it in that film, or?
There's a couple things I should show you if you want to continue your work on that. You've done a bunch of real interesting work at NYU. There's records of how many prints were made. The negative was stashed at Paramount for a while. Because there were prints made for some theatrical prints. I think 120 prints were made, but they weren't in circulation for very long. And then it was reborn as a vocational subject, meaning that it was circulated mainly to people who were either contemplating a career in auto or who were being tracked into such a career. And actually, today, it's still a film that it plays very well to audiences that you might call, you know, gearheads. It's a very interesting. But it turned into a vocational subject. I'm not aware that it was released in 16 millimeter. It was released just before the war. It was cut into a variant version, which has a lot of militaristic stuff at the end. I mean, it's very interesting. I think there's only one copy of that, which is now at LC. But I don't think it had that much of a life, actually. It's not in any catalogs that I've ever seen. Yeah. So I just think that it's, when you compare this film to American Look, it's an interesting, by the time American Look was made, the balance in sort of a commercial speech, I'm thinking of industrial films in a very broad sense as commercial speech, the balance seems to have shifted to favor consumption. And in fact, in American Look, they're not even necessarily consuming products of use so much as they're consuming products for stylistic reasons. They're buying appearances. It's a film that's already several levels removed from necessity, as in Once Upon a Honeymoon. You know, the phone is no longer something you have to call the doctor or call your family. It's a style. It's a decorator accessory. So it's a shift, I think, in a broad-based shift in commercial speech from production to consumption. And I know, you know, there's a million ways to talk about this, and I don't mean to make this an overwhelming, but it's these are two very nice examples of that shift. So thank you. It's been a long screening and a great privilege to show these. Appreciate it.
Even though it is late, I will see you in the morning for a very entertaining Saturday morning traditional cartoon education thingy. You'll You'll be haunted by Roe Revis the rest of your life, so don't sleep in and miss Roe Revis.
Except us. Awesome. That's a major thing. Everyone else I've heard from...